shattered the Western forces, pushing them back across the bridge and into a full retreat. Rather than extending their line into Western territory, however, the ironclad-led army pulled back, destroying the bridge. The bridge had remained shattered for over 100 years, until now. 5 years ago, Gareth's father, King Oran Ironclad, had ordered the bridge to be rebuilt. Like the ill will harbored against the North, he had long wanted revenge against the Westerners for their mistreatment of Oriens. The bridge would provide an easy means for a full-scale assault, in which he hoped to end the East-West War once and for all. Last Gareth had seen the bridge, about a year ago, it had been half-completed, though progress was slow due to daily attacks by Western archers. Now Gareth marvelled at the solid, walled bridge that spanned the lake. Its stone walls and columns were plated with iron sheets, transported one at a time from ironwood, where skilled Oriens channeled the natural ore deposits provided by their ancient forest. His brother Grian, who now stood as the king of the East, had been responsible for the project. "Perhaps he will be a great king," Gareth thought. "If he can achieve something like this, perhaps he will one day lead us to victory. Perhaps this is why I failed to save Guy. If Grian was meant to be king..." He shook his head at his own foolishness. "Now I sound like Roan and Gwen," he mused. Talk of fate and destiny was naught but an attempt to explain the randomness of bad luck and ill fortune. "No, I failed because I wasn't strong enough. I failed because I was too slow. But I shall not fail again, not on this night." The fury began funneling onto the bridge, forming a wall in front of him. Two remained at his side, ensuring he didn't attempt anything reckless. Anyway, he was tied firmly to his mount, his hands secured behind his back. "I can barely move, much less throw myself over the side of the bridge. But that doesn't mean I can't do something," he thought. "The fools should have sealed my lips when they had the chance." He stared ahead, pretending his fear was naught but excitement, the tingling thrill most soldiers felt the night before a battle. Near the center of the bridge, the furious stopped, their horses stamping and snorting. "Where?" Gareth wondered, for he saw nothing but dark waters lapping against the stone columns, the twinkling lights of portage, a path of darkness running from the bridge and across the border into the east. And then they were there. Dozens of riders in full metal, both human and Orion. In the midst, one held a flag, which snapped as a strong wind blew from the south. The flag bore the crossed iron swords of the east, the royal ironclad sigil. "A symbol of strength, and you shall not pass, and I am the shield, not the sword," Gareth thought. "The sigil is no longer mine to claim." He saw him, riding up the field toward the front. His brother, Grian, the youngest of the triplets, but now a man grown, a born leader, decisive. Gareth immediately noticed the changes in his brother. His typically messy hair was combed neatly, poking out in clean strands from the helm he wore. His riding stance was more erect, prouder, not the brash, charge-into-battle position he used to prefer. Though his face was once identical to Gareth's, now it seemed like the face of a stranger. The jaw firmer, the eyes sharper and wiser, the eyebrows narrowed in determination. He looked every bit like the king he was meant to be the moment Guy was killed in battle. "And yet I'm older, the next in line for the throne." Gareth gritted his teeth and forced away the thought the moment it appeared. No matter what Roan said, he would never be king. Immediately behind Grian was a figure nearly half again as large as the king, an imposing warrior Gareth had seen kill hundreds of lesser men in battle. A descendant of the mountain men of the north, Bjorn Stonesledge stood over 8 feet tall, his legs as thick as small trees, his arms battering rams. He rode a horse stolen in battle from the Phoenicians, who bred the largest steeds in the Four Kingdoms, the only ones large enough to carry his weight. He wore an iron pendant shaped like a fist around his neck, an exact replica of the skin mark he bore on his flesh, the source of his incredible strength and prowess in battle. As awe-inspiring as Bjorn was, Gareth had once called him a friend. Now the man refused to look at him. Gryon also avoided Gareth's stare, as if he didn't exist. "They're ashamed of me. They think I'm here to ruin them, to fail all over again. I won't. I promise." He formed the words in his head, ready to scream them as soon as he was certain his brother would hear. But Roan. But Gwen. Though the thought of never seeing them again broke his heart into dagger-like shards, this was what he had to do. His chance at redemption. His final chance to be the shield he became the moment he emerged from his mother's womb ahead of his brother's. He opened his mouth, knowing the Furia on each side would be too slow to stop him. "Do not ransom me, brother! Archers, shoot me! Shoot me! Shoot me! For the East! I am the shield!" But his words never emerged, for his brother, King Gryon Ironclad, spoke first. His words were like knives. "It seems you have come a long way for nothing," he said, speaking directly to the Fury. Gareth squinted, trying to make sense of his brother's words. "Wait, does he mean—" "There shall be no ransom for Gareth, not today, not tomorrow, not ever. The moment he failed to protect my brother, Guy Ironclad, heir to the Eastern Throne, the moment he failed as shield, that was the moment he stopped being my brother. And when he fled from the East, like the coward he is, he showed us his true colours, a pale shade of yellow." A pit formed in Gareth's stomach. Bitterness coated his tongue. "I want to die," he thought. "You would dare go back on your agreement with Queen Lorraine?" the Fury asked, her words filled with venom. "Oh, yes, I dare," Gryon said. "If you want to contend it, we can do battle here, on the bridge that once represented the strength of the West, now rebuilt by the strength of the East. Perhaps you will kill me. Perhaps you will kill Bjorn. But you will not kill all of us. You and your sisters will die, and then you won't be able to deliver our message." "What message?" a growled question. "That we are coming for your queen. Night's End will fail, and you and your false god will fade into history, lost to all but memory." Gareth knew he could still say the words, still call for the archers to end him. Now more than ever he was certain his brother would allow it, even command it. But instead he breathed a ragged, quavering breath, refusing to cry, refusing to give Gryon the satisfaction. A few grains of sand trickled through the hourglass of time, settling silently. In some ways Gareth hoped the Fury would attack, would force his brother's hand. But in a million other ways he wanted her to walk away. "Yes, I want to die," he admitted again to himself. "But not like this. Not for a brother who hates me. Not for a kingdom that shuns me." Without another word, the Fury wheeled her horse around and retreated across the bridge, heading westward. Her Furia followed, occasionally flicking dark stares in Gareth's direction. Now that he was useless as a prisoner, he knew Rhea would kill him. 12. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Ennis Lorraine.
"Rothdam Darkspell, and his wrath-forsaken potion! And Rothdam my stubborn cousin and her arrogant ways!"
3 days earlier, Ennis had been rendered helpless by a single drop of Darkspell's potion. He'd stared, seeing all, but unable to do anything, not even to change the direction his eyes faced. His mind had been fully functioning, which was, perhaps, the cruelest truth of all, for he was a prisoner in his own paralyzed body, his thoughts spinning wildly like a tornado as he was carried to his quarters, set on his bed and left to stare at the ceiling. He had slept on and off and on, for what felt like days and days, though, according to the potion master, the effects should only last for a day. Even that amount of time was too long, he had known. Still, he'd clung to hope that he wouldn't be too late. As soon as his stiff legs and sore arms had become his own to command once more, he'd rushed from the guard's quarters, not even bothering to wait for the mechanical lift to carry him up, instead taking the steps around and around and around, his stiff muscles burning, screaming, his lungs heaving, throwing open the door to the tower cell, which was empty. Gareth was gone.
No,
he'd breathed, nearly breaking his neck as he'd flown down the steps three at a time, stumbling from the staircase and rushing to the palace gates, hoping against hope that they hadn't left for the Bridge of Triumph yet. For the last 2 days, Ennis had been sleepwalking, going about his guard duties with numb disconnect. In the past, he'd tried reasoning with his cousin, tried appealing to the girl he knew she once was, and now he'd tried to commit treason, and had once more failed. He was but a man, while Rhea seemed almost supernatural in her ability to stay ahead of him, to forge a new path across the Four Kingdoms, riddled with corpses and bloodstains. She didn't kill you, he reminded himself. It was that single truth that had sustained him thus far, but even that fact seemed to matter less and less with each of his failures. Now a stream had arrived from Restor, and Ennis could guess it was from the Fury, confirmation of Gareth being traded for Bjorn Stonesledge. He watched as Rhea's eyes gleamed when she snatched the still-wet parchment from the messenger. Her lips moved as she read. Ennis dropped his head, wallowing in the muck of failure, as potent as sewer sludge. Rhea screamed an obscenity, and Ennis's head jerked up. In typical Rhea fashion, she was tearing the parchment to shreds, one ragged piece at a time. No one spoke, though Ennis was desperate to know what the message said. Anything that sent Rhea into a rage like the one she was in now was worth knowing. Finally, after the message lay in wet tatters at her feet, Rhea said,
"Gareth will be rejoining us in Night's End. Bjorn Stonesledge will not."
Ennis's heart leapt. He didn't know how it was possible, but something had caused the ransom to fail. There was still hope. The moment Gareth returned to the city, he could lay plans to help him escape.
"I will execute Gareth ironclad myself,"
Rhea growled.
"What?"
The question burst from Ennis's lips before he could stop it. Rhea's head turned slowly toward him, her eyes narrowing. He could see the recognition in her expression as soon as she realized who had spoken.
"Guard," she said, "do you have something to say? Ben Gentry, correct? The subject of Darkspell's little experiment. Nice to see you're back in control of your own arms and legs."
The scathing look she fired at him was almost a threat.
"Cross me, and you will pay dearly." "Yes. I mean, no. I have nothing to say."
Ennis hated that he had to play this game, that he no longer had the ear of his own queen, the cousin who he'd played with when she was just a little girl, innocent, unbroken, full of vibrancy and life. She started to turn away.
"Wait," he said.
Her head swiveled back to him, her eyes flashing.
"I was just wondering whether the prince might still have value. Perhaps one of our enemies want him."
"It was a long shot, but no," Rhea said.
"If Gareth cannot be ransomed, he is of no use to me. He dies."
Those two words ended the conversation before it ever really started. And Ennis knew he was down to only one option. He would rescue Gwendolyn Storm instead. Then Rhea couldn't kill Gareth, as she would need him to force her brother, Roan, to do her will. 13. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Gwendolyn Storm. She waited like a predator in the dark, her eyes closed, her mouth too. She controlled her breathing, slow and even, the rise and fall of her chest hidden beneath her breastplate. She hung from the wall by her neck, her feet dangling, her head slumped forward. The facade hadn't been particularly difficult to create, though Gwen had had to be creative with raw materials. First, she'd torn 7 strips of fabric from the trousers she wore beneath her armor. It had been difficult without removing her armor, but she'd managed, digging her fingernails between gaps in the plate, tearing with hands that were made for tasks requiring strength of grip. Why 7 strips? no particular reason, except it felt right to do while imprisoned in Night's End, where the seventh heaven was the ultimate goal for its citizens. Next she'd tied the strips together, and then created a noose, double-thick all the way around, and triple-tied where it would secure the back of her neck to the wall. The ill-maintained stone wall of her dungeon cell was ripe with holes and crevasses, in which a rope could be tied. Still, she wanted to ensure the location she chose wouldn't crumble away under the weight of her armored body. The hole she'd finally discovered was the size of a fist, but still had enough of a stone bridge over top that it would hold her weight. The only challenge was the height. It was nearly to the dank, dripping ceiling, a good jump for a mere mortal. Luckily, Gwendolyn Storm was no mere mortal. Even for her kind, the Aurians, she was an anomaly, her hero mark adding height and distance to her leaps, power to her strikes, precision to her every move. She jumped, grabbing the thinnest of handholds with the tips of her fingers, clinging to it like an oar monkey. Ha! Gareth would have appreciated the reference. Quickly, she'd tied her noose with one hand, using her teeth to pull it taut. Lastly, she'd stuck her head through and let gravity and her weight do the rest, pulling the double-layered cloth noose tight against her throat, which was protected by iron plate. Now she waited, as still as stone, letting a cool draught shift her slowly from side to side. She heard a door creak open. Footsteps on stone. Heavy boots. Different than the sound of the earless dungeon master's typical approach, which was scraping and scuffling and less heavy by half. She squinted, peering through the strands of silvery hair that had fallen over her face. A shadow holding a too bright lantern stopped in front of her cell, releasing a gasp the moment he saw her.
"Oh, Roth!"
a male voice hissed. Frantically, he slung the lantern to the ground with a clank, fumbled at the keys jingling in his hands, tried one key, then another. Gwendolyn took the opportunity to study him now that the lantern illuminated much of the newcomer's form. He was tall, with light hair poking out from a helmet. A thick blonde beard covered much of his face. She couldn't make out the color of his eyes, but he wore hefty guardsman armor. The left breastplate was ornamented with the Royal Stallion of the West. Gwen could almost imagine the horse as it stood atop the cliff, its legs kicking as it reared in triumph. The sigil was a symbol of the original defeat of the Crimeans in the First Independence War. "Who is this man?" she wondered. "And why is he here?" Finally, the lock clicked as the man, "my prey," she reminded herself, found the correct key. Had she truly been hanging herself, she would have died long before this fool got the door open. He shoved the door inward, letting it clang against the inside of the bars.
"Wait."
He scampered through, reaching for her feet.
"Wait."
She felt her body rise, the pressure on the armor around her throat releasing.
"Wait."
She'd intentionally made the loop of the noose too large by half, making it easier to pull it over her head. When he lifted her further, she ducked her head and the makeshift rope fell away perfectly.
"Wait."
He began to lower her to the ground, slowly, delicately, as if afraid she would shatter into a thousand pieces if he moved too swiftly.
"Now."
Gwen snapped her feet over his head, locking them together as tightly as an oar panther's jaws. He released a muffled cry just before she somersaulted backwards, springing off her hands and launching him crashing into the wall. And then she was on him, slipping his own sword from its sheath and pressing the tip into his throat.
"I should kill him," she thought.
But for some reason she paused. After all, he'd tried to save her from hanging himself.
"Why did you come here?"
she hissed instead. For days and days she'd seen only the dungeon master, heard nothing but his scuffling footsteps, ragged cough and grunts, and the whimpers of the other prisoners. Though his eyes were wide as he scanned her face, she sensed no fear in them.
"This man is not afraid of death."
The realization surprised her. It's not what she expected from a mere castle guardsman.
"To rescue you,"
he said, matter-of-factly. For just a moment, she released the pressure of the blade against his throat. He might have sensed it, might have taken advantage of the opportunity to counter-attack, but instead he only slumped back, rubbing his neck.
"Nice trick,"
he said. "Why would you rescue me?"
"Because I made a promise."
"To whom?"
"Gareth Ironclad."
She jammed the blade back against his flesh. The edge pierced his skin, drawing a single drop of blood.
"You lie. I wouldn't expect you to believe me, but it's true. I spoke to him, offered to free him. His only condition was that I release you at the same time."
Some instinct made her think she should believe him. Why would he lie? To save his own skin, possibly, but that wouldn't explain why he was here in the first place. What he was saying would.
"Where is Gareth?"
The man shook his head, and there was a sadness in the gesture, a resignation.
"Tell me."
He told her what he knew, how Gareth had been sent to be ransomed, how something had gone wrong, and that he was being brought back to Night's End. How Rhea had vowed to kill him, now that he had no value to her.
"If I rescue you, then Rhea cannot kill Gareth. She'll need him as leverage over Roan."
It all made sense, except for the fact that this man was helping them.
"Who are you, really?"
she asked.
"I'm Ennis Loren," he said.
Before she could laugh, he explained everything. His faked death, his false identity, the appointment as a guardsman. Gwen hid her surprise. From her experiences with Rhea Loren, she wasn't the type to spare the life of someone who'd crossed her. This man, her cousin, must mean a great deal to her. Still, even if Ennis's heart was pure, he was still looking out for the best interests of the West, not the East.
"I'm leaving," she said. "You're staying."
He nodded, as if he'd been expecting her to say exactly that.
"I don't blame you. But if I leave with you, we may be able to help Gareth escape, too."
She chewed on that. Yes, her mark made her ideal for just such a rescue operation, but it would be easier with an inside man.
"You weren't seen coming here?"
He shook his head.
"I took the dungeon master from behind."
"You killed him?" Another headshake.
"Paralyzed him, using a potion concocted by Darkspell. I stole it from his chambers."
She frowned, trying to recall where she'd heard that name before, but he cut her off.
"It's a long story. I'll tell it to you once we're away from here. Rhea could visit at any moment. You're her most valuable prisoner now, or at least that's what she thinks."
Gwen's mind ticked over the facts, weighing the risks and rewards. If she locked him up and left, she could return to the East and rejoin her people. Gareth would be safe, for a time, as leverage over Roan.
"But can I really abandon him, when there might be a way to save him now?"
If what this man, Ennis Loren, had said was true, then Gareth had attempted to rescue her before himself. She growled her frustration. Each option carried an equal number of risks, and none of them pleasant.
"Lead the way, Loren," she said. "But we better find a certain paralyzed dungeon master on the way out."
Gwen might have kicked the dungeon master in the ribs as they passed his stiff body. It also might have been unjustified, considering he'd been the one to feed her every day. But it had felt so good. Afterwards, they dragged him into her cell and locked the door. Gwen left her makeshift noose on his chest. With any luck, Rhea would believe Gwen had escaped completely on her own, fooling the master. The only problem was the paralyzing potion Ennis had used to knock him out. One way or another, however, the clues would lead to Darkspell, not to him. Hopefully, by the time Rhea learned the truth, the three of them would be long gone. Now Ennis guided her away from the main stairs to a shadowy side exit. She wasn't too concerned that he would spin around and try to kill her. After all, she still had his sword. Plus, he hadn't lied about the dungeon master. Then again, the best liars wove some truth into their deceptions. Thus, Gwen remained alert, prepared to shove Ennis's blade through his spine if he led her astray. The lantern cast an orange halo as they ascended, the light bouncing with each step. At the top was a wooden trapdoor.
"Where does it lead?"
Gwen asked in a hushed voice.
"Storeroom. Food is brought down for the prisoners."
"I wouldn't call it food, exactly." Ennis had no response to that. He raised a hand in the air, and she understood his meaning.
"Wait here."
Though she was reluctant to leave his side, she had no other option. If he raised the alarm, she could always fight her way through, or flee back down the steps and find an alternate escape route. He pushed open the trapdoor, climbing out. Darkness and silence greeted him. He poked his head back inside the stairwell and said, "Come on." Through a small room they went, the shelves on either side full of sacks and baskets of dry foods. Gwen ignored the ache in her stomach. Ennis had timed it well, which Gwen was certain was no coincidence. The kitchen was empty of staff, the stone oven unlit, the dishes from the day's final meal washed and set out to dry. Ennis blew out his lantern and set it on a table. From there they exited through a door that led outside, where it was dark. The clouds were allies, white ships sailing across an ocean of night, obliterating the light from the moons and stars. Lush foliage, elm and spruce trees, holly bushes, and square-cut hedges, provided excellent cover from any lookouts who might be watching from the castle walls. Pink bougainvillea crept up the sides of the squat stone building that housed the kitchens, storerooms, and, apparently, the dungeons. Ennis reached inside a thick bush. Gwen watched him curiously until he retrieved a long, white, hooded purity dress, which he handed to her. "Put this on." If she'd had any doubt about his intentions before, they were chased away by this final part of his planning. Still, she placed the sword on the ground, standing on the broadside with both feet, and then rapidly pulled the dress over her head, tucking her silver hair beneath the hood. It didn't fit particularly well. Then again, based on the other women she'd seen wearing them throughout the city, she didn't think it was meant to hug her form. No, it was meant to cover. A thought that made her teeth grind together. She picked up the sword. "I'm keeping this," she said, "just in case there was any doubt." Ennis didn't argue. "Hide it under the dress." She did, and he said, "You'll have to wait in the gardens until morning, when they reopen the castle gates. Unless, of course, you can scale a sheer stone wall without a rope." He chuckled softly. Gwen did not. "I'll take the wall," she said. "I don't want to spend another moment inside this place. Not tonight." He gawked at her. "They say the forest dwellers of the East are unusual, but I'd never met one until you." "And?" "You are unusual, but not so different as I expected." "Right. Anyway, if you truly can scale the wall by hand, return to the gardens on the morrow, when the moons approach each other in the night sky. I will be here, waiting." She nodded. "When will Gareth return to Night's End?" "We received a stream from Brestor today. The way the Fury ride, he could arrive as early as tomorrow afternoon, if not the following morning." Gwen didn't know what else to say except, "Thank you, and I'm sorry I attacked you." "Like I said, it was a good trick. You had me fooled. And you're welcome, but I'm not doing this for you nor Gareth. I only want peace and prosperity for the West. Unlike my young, misguided cousin, I'm willing to consider an alliance with the East to achieve that. Gareth is an opportunity I refuse to waste." "Fair enough. Until we meet again." With a burst of leaves, Gwen slipped through the bushes. 14. The Hinterlands. Lisbeth Lorne. Lisbeth awoke to a rough hand on her neck. Instinctively, she sucked in a breath before the hand began to squeeze. Her attacker's soul was shadowy, but the white, pulsing soul of Crone appeared behind as she leapt atop his back, releasing a guttural scream. The male was strong, likely one of the warriors, and easily bucked the old female away, sending her crashing into the snow-packed walls of her dwelling. He squeezed Lisbeth's throat harder. "No," she thought. At the same moment she saw his soul clarify, illuminated by the light that swarmed from the glowing eye on her forehead, probing into him, feeling around in his skull, gripping his soul as tightly as he squeezed her throat. It was Xur, the warrior who'd twice threatened her. His grip lost all strength, and he howled, falling back. The young girl wearing the white dress waded into the water. Despite the snow and ice covering the land around the lake, the water flowed freely. Lisbeth could feel it. It was strangely warm. Could feel the fluttering fear as the girl's heart beat too rapidly in her chest. She turned and looked back, tears sparkling in her wide brown eyes.
"Father?"
she said. A question in that single word. A question without an answer. The male Ghazi warrior, her father, Zur, said,
"Be free, my star."
And then he turned his back on her, his only child. The girl didn't see the tears dripping from his eyes, freezing on his cheeks in silvery lines. She didn't see the way his breath choked him, nor how he stumbled over feet that had always been sure in the past, now devoid of all strength and coordination. No, she didn't see any of that, because his back was to her, and she'd already turned around to face the water, crying, pushing off with both feet and letting the current surround her.
"No!"
Lisbeth screamed, clawing at her own face, as if she could drag the images from her skull the way she'd forced them from his.
"Girl should hush,"
Crone said, cradling Lisbeth's head in the crook of her arm. The ancient woman winced as she spoke, and she was carrying her other arm strangely, too tight against her ribs.
"She's injured,"
Lisbeth thought, the realization chasing away the images she'd seen in Zer's head.
"Zur,"
she remembered. The warrior was on the ground, his boots scuffing trenches in the snow as he writhed and twisted, clutching his head. Blood flowed freely from his nose, his ears, his mouth.
"What have I done?"
she whispered.
"Girl, does nothing Zur would not do,"
Crone said. When the woman tried to move, she hissed in pain, clutching her shoulder. Lisbeth barely noticed, however, her eyes focused on Zur, who had finally stopped squirming, his eyes closed, his body unnaturally still.
"Oh, sun! Oh, moon! Oh, stars! Is he dead?"
she asked. To answer her own question, she reached forward to touch his chest, to feel for a heartbeat. Zur jolted up with such abruptness, Lisbeth fell backward, releasing a yelp of surprise. His eyes were wide, darting around, as if searching for something but seeing nothing, unable to focus. He scratched at his head, tearing at the strands of black hair, ripping them out. He shouted something in Ghazi, spit flying from his lips.
"Gash nom, zuf dari!"
He repeated the same phrase again and again and again, before collapsing from exhaustion, his chest rising and falling in huge waves. Lisbeth didn't need Crone to translate his words.
"Girl, steal soul. Girl, steal soul. Girl, steal."
Lisbeth ran into a storm-filled night, afraid of herself, afraid of what she'd done to the warrior Zur, afraid of what she'd seen in his head, that girl in the water. At any moment she expected strong hands to grab her, to go for her throat. She didn't fear them, but what she might do to them. But none appeared. Ghostly hands of snow her only companion as she raced onwards, past snow structures nearly invisible in the storm. Her plan was to get as far away from the Ghazi city as she could, as fast as she could. It was what they wanted. She would miss Crone, her first and only real friend and ally, but that couldn't be helped. An enormous shadow rose up on her right, and Lisbeth skidded to a stop, panting, icy nettles pelting her face, melting on her now warm skin. She remembered what Crone had called this soulless place, Hall of War. And yet, despite the emptiness she felt as she looked upon it, despite the shadows that seemed to surround its icy flanks, which rose into the sky like a snow-covered mountain, she could see the pulses of color within, like hundreds of beating hearts. Souls, she knew. The urge was still there to flee this place, to leave forever and never return, but she also felt drawn to the Hall of War, to the souls within which were sleeping?
No, not sleeping, but not awake either. Something else.
Something in between, like the place between living and dying, a void filled with ribbons of light. A place all too familiar to Lisbeth. She could feel their wills pressing against the walls, their resistance to leave this world. She walked toward the hall, its open entrance, the dark yawn of a slumbering beast. She stepped inside, feeling as if she was being swallowed whole. The inside, however, didn't feel soulless or empty or dark. Though she was aware that in the stormy night there was no outward light in this place, Light was all she could see. Pulsing forms of souls, crimson, lilac, jade, turquoise, amber, sapphire. The sight took her breath away, not only because of the kaleidoscope of colours beating in perfect sync with each other, like separate parts of the same heart, but because she could hear them speaking to her in the deepest recesses of her mind. "The time has come," they said as one. "The North will soon fall."
"Who are you?"
she asked aloud, for they did not speak Garzi, and their mastery of the common language was flawless. Silence. Silence. And then?
"We are those who sleep, warriors from another age, another land. The soul-marked seeks what we offer."
It wasn't the clearest of answers, and yet Lisbeth felt the truth of their words thrumming through her. She felt the honour in their souls, the devotion to a cause that was a part of them, each one of them, as well as the collective whole.
"And what do you offer?"
Their response was a single word.
"War."
15. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anise Garrick. The pact was an ancient agreement between anyone residing south of Frozen Lake and the peoples of the hinterlands. According to what Archer had been told growing up, the pact had been signed thousands of years ago, well before the Crimean explorers ever set foot on the lands now known as the Four Kingdoms. The pact was a promise. No one in the hinterlands shall travel south, and no one south shall travel north. In essence, don't cross the line. Men had died for breaking the pact, including one of Anise's most famous relatives, Heinrich Garrick, the great explorer who'd led the voyage that discovered these lands in the first place. The story had been passed down from generation to generation by his son, Thomas, who was the first Garrick to declare independence from the Crimeans. Thomas had seen his father die at the hands of the people who lived north, the Garzi, they were called. Riding vicious beasts, they claimed all lands north of Frozen Lake, exactly where Anise's map indicated she would find the sleeping knights. The night was still and silent, but Anise couldn't sleep, much weighing on her mind. Would she truly lead the hand-picked group into the hinterlands, breaking the pact and sealing their dooms? Archer and Sir Dietrich and Sir Jonius and Sir Met, good men, who had fought and miraculously survived by her side. Did she have any other choice?
"I could go alone," she thought.
"The risk would be all mine to bear." She knew they wouldn't let her, and even if she snuck away, they would follow. And anyway, the North was ripe for the taking, and she knew their enemies would arrive to pluck it from the branch soon enough. She had no way to stop them. The legendary Sleeping Knights were a chance, a hope.
"We will risk it. I will risk it."
The decision made, she knew sleep would continue to elude her. So finally, finally, she unraveled the scrolls Terin had left for her before he slipped away.
"His stories," Anise thought. "The parts of his life I know little to nothing about."
And finally, she was strong enough to read them. Terin's stories had made her laugh, cry, want to break things, and urged her to race off into the night to find him, to hold him, to tell him she was sorry for not understanding the depths of his fears, his sorrows, his doubts. In the name of war, he had done terrible things. Things he hadn't even wanted to do, but which he'd enjoyed, or at least the monster living inside him had enjoyed. He'd killed without mercy. He'd shattered foes by the hundreds, single-handedly winning several crucial battles for the North. He remembered all. At times, he hated himself. At times, he wanted to die. He feared being close to anyone, feared to love, to desire, for he knew in the end he would destroy anyone and everyone around him. And yet, he'd tried for Anise. He loved her so much he had risked her life, just something else he regretted, hated himself for. He called it his greatest act of selfishness, a phrase that made it hard for Anise to swallow.
How could what we have be anything but selfless?
When she was finished reading, Anise rolled the parchment into a single thick scroll, tied a bit of twine around it, and hid it in a box under blankets and pillows. When she closed the lid, she knew Taryn was gone. Now, finally, she could sleep. Her hands traced the taut lines of his muscled arms. Had they been forged of iron, they would not be any stronger. His back, shoulders, and chest might have been chiseled by a master stone carver. His face, his jaw, speckled with half a day of stubble, were as strong as the rest of him. And they were hers. They were all hers.
Oh, Taryn.
She arched into him, thinking this moment could slide into eternity, wishing it would. His hands were gentle but greedy, rolling over her as they melted into each other, as they became one. And the things he whispered into her ear, his gravelly tone full of desperation and longing.
I prefer your eyes to the stars, your tongue to the sweetest wine, your lips to breathing.
They left her breathless and alive and trembling with desire. And when he said her name,
Anise,
like a word carried on a warm wind, all she could do was gasp, and she did gasp, that is, shooting up in bed, her heart pounding, her sleep-tangled hair streaking her vision, her lungs heaving.
Bloody frozen hell below, she thought. Did I really just have a sex dream?
For a second she felt rather foolish, but then, remembering how it had been with Taryn in real life, how good it had been, how right, she felt less foolish. She sank back into her pillows, wishing she could close her eyes and have that dream again and again, and forget about the madness of today's venture into the hinterlands and her shattered kingdom, and just, for once, perhaps she could be truly happy. All that was chased away when the sun rose a moment later, blades of orange light slashing through her window. The sky immediately above Castle Hill was clear and blue and free of snow. However, to the east, she saw the towers of thick grey clouds building, crossing toward her like the great warships of her enemies. With an exhausted groan, she dragged herself out of bed. She could delay the fate of the kingdom no longer. "You understand the risk?" Anise asked. She told them everything Arch had told her about the pact, with him correcting or filling in blanks where necessary. Despite that, each of her party of five nodded in turn, wearing grave expressions. "I will not command you to accompany me into the hinterlands, especially given this new information. I will go alone if necessary. It is a great risk, but I believe we have no other option, not if we want our great kingdom to survive the coming storm. Regardless of whether the sleeping knights are naught but a legend, I need to know the truth. We must seek out allies in every nook and corner we can." Aunt Zelda was there to see them off. She said,
"Bring our knights home."
She spoke around a thick, sour roll she was chewing. Anise nodded.
"In my absence, I hereby grant you, Lady Zelda Garrick, all the powers, authority, and determination of law that I hold as Queen of the North."
Zelda took another bite of her roll and then said,
"The dread King of the North is rolling over in his grave."
Anise couldn't help the laugh that slipped out. After all, if she couldn't laugh under the gravest of circumstances, what was the point of any of this? She turned to Sir Metz. She had one more order of business before they left.
"Sir Metz," she said.
"Your Highness?"
He stood a little straighter, his armour gleaming in the rare northern sunlight.
"You will not accompany us north."
He stared at her, and though he controlled his expression, she could see the disappointment flashing in his eyes.
"Have I done something wrong?" he asked.
"No,"
she said quickly. That was the last thing she wanted him to think. But she needed to make this very clear, or else the knight would figure out a way to interpret her response in such a way that he could follow them.
"I trust your honour above all others, even my own. I need you to continue the soldier training program started by Sir Dietrich.
I can think of no other who would better serve in this regard. You will remain in Castle Hill, continuing to recruit soldiers and train them to the highest standards. You will take further commands from Lady Zelda." His disappointment morphed to pride.
"I will do this thing."
"You will not follow us into the hinterlands. That is a command. Do you understand?"
"Yes, Your Highness," he said.
A twinge of regret spiked inside Anise, surprising her. She would miss having this loyal man. Not only was he a first-class swordsman, but she now considered him a friend, though he might not think the same. "May we meet again," she thought, turning away from two people she cared for greatly. She aimed her face to the north, to the ice-sheathed surface of Frozen Lake and the rolling snow dunes of the hinterlands beyond. The first winter storm of the season hit before the sun reached its peak. 16. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Tairin Shiri. The blade-like towers of the castle seemed poised to fall, slashing Darin and those who remained in the city to ribbons. The torn flesh covering Tairin's knuckles continued to weep blood, dripping in the snow, which was packed down hard and alive with prints from horses' hooves. Tairin raised his eyes to the sky, squinting at the brightness of the thin, white clouds.
"What now?" he thought.
Fae said, "The horses are gone." It was as Tairin feared. The lord of the castle, Lord Darin, had fled the city, abandoning it to the east. Any hope of mustering a force large enough to defend the city had left with him. Tairin turned when he heard footsteps approaching from behind. The soldiers from the barracks, now all fully dressed and in somewhat rumpled uniforms, stopped in a ragged line, Captain Morris at their head.
"You're leaving us too, aren't you?" he said.
His round cheeks were ruddy from the cold.
"Aye," Tairin said. "I'm leaving you."
He walked past them without looking back. Fae caught up to him just as he passed the barracks on the way out of the city.
"Coward,"
she muttered. He didn't stop, couldn't stop.
"How do you figure?"
he said as he lengthened his strides.
"Lord Darin is a coward. Captain Morris and his so-called soldiers are cowards. I'm merely being realistic. This city is forfeit, along with what's left of its defences."
"Excuses," said Fae, stopping. Tairin whirled around.
"Just because we're old acquaintances doesn't mean that you know me," he said. "So stop pretending like you do."
"Fair enough," Fae said. "You best be on your way. It's a long march to the next city, which I'm certain will be more hospitable than Darin. I'm certain you will find plenty of walls to crush your fists against there." He stared at her.
"What will you do?"
"Stay here. Stand against the east."
"That's suicide. Morris and the others are planning to surrender."
"Then I shall fight alone."
"You're not even a soldier,"
Tairin said, though he immediately regretted the words. Anise hadn't been a soldier either, and yet she was a warrior all the same, as formidable in battle as 100 Captain Morrises. Nay, 1,000. The Dread King didn't allow women in his army, remember? Though clearly he favoured fools based on present company.
"I deserve that," Tairin thought. "You can fight."
"Don't sound so surprised. You think someone with no experience in combat can design and forge the weaponry I do?" Tairin took a guess.
"Your father taught you to fight."
Fae blew out a disgusted breath. "Men of the North are so narrow-minded. My father left my mother and I before I could walk. My mother taught me. She was once a she-knight, one of less than 12 in the last 2 centuries. Tairin couldn't hide his surprise, nor his shame. He was narrow-minded, though he didn't mean to be. He just wasn't used to seeing women in battle. And he'd never seen a she-knight in his life, though he'd heard of them. Supposedly there was one in Blackstone, but she'd likely died in the assault on Night's End.
"I'm sorry. I didn't know."
"You never asked." When he opened his mouth to respond, she held up a hand to stop him. "I know
I get it. When I first met you, you were still figuring out who you were. There wasn't exactly time to get to know me or Bart. But now you know. I can fight. I can forge weapons for the men here. I can try to convince them not to surrender.
Then you will die, Terin said.
Perhaps. Perhaps not. But I will die defending this kingdom, as Anise and her aunt are doing. If the men won't protect these lands, the women will.
Terin closed his eyes. One way or another, he had to do something. He couldn't stop moving, not for 1 minute longer. To stop was to think, to dwell, to remember. Action was the only way to silence the voice, to blur the memories. Whatever path he chose, he would throw himself into it with the entirety of his being. It was the only way he knew how to live inside his own skin.
"I'll stay. I'll help you," he said.
As Fay's lips curled into a broad grin, he wondered whether he'd just made the biggest mistake of his life. Grudgingly, Captain Morris and his men had scoured the city, locating all remaining soldiers, most of whom were still drunk from the night before, and gathering them in the castle courtyard. Though their training and abilities remained in doubt, Terin was pleased to find more than 200 men still occupied the city.
"The leftovers," he reminded himself.
Still, leftovers could satisfy if heated and salted and stirred. Several of the men began arguing, shoving each other and uttering curses about mothers.
"Maybe not these leftovers," Terin thought.
Captain Morris approached.
"That's as many as we could find. There might be another dozen or so hiding, but they'll poke their heads out of the snow eventually."
"Good. Thank you," Terin said,
scanning the men for Fay's familiar slender form. He spotted her as she emerged from a dark stone building with iron bars over the windows. He frowned. Why was she in the prison? Realization set in when he saw four men appear behind her, their arms and legs shackled together. Fay grinned and waved. Terin pinched the skin between his eyes, where a headache had begun to throb.
"Criminals and castaways," he thought.
He released the skin, which continued to ache.
"Doesn't matter. Keep moving. Keep doing. That's all I have left."
Fay brought the shackled men past the soldiers, many of whom jeered and shouted insults at them.
"Four more recruits," she said when she reached Terin.
Terin eyed each of them in turn. Two stared at their feet. One stared at the sky like he hadn't seen it in a long time. And the fourth met Terin's eyes with a steel gaze, nodding once in his direction.
"Do you want to know their crimes?" Fay asked.
"No," Terin said. "We have all done things we regret. But today is a new beginning."
The two who'd been staring at their feet looked up through tendrils of long, dirty hair. The one staring at the sky continued to stare. And the fourth blinked, as if surprised. Terin accepted a key from Fay and unshackled them one at a time. Three of them, rubbing their ankles and wrists, melted into the crowd which parted in the middle. Not to accept them, but to avoid them, or so it seemed. The fourth, the man with the steel eyes, didn't move, didn't massage his raw skin. He wasn't young, but not old either, and his expression didn't contain the same defeat nor brokenness that most prisoners, in Terin's experience, had.
"Do you not remember me?" he asked.
Terin frowned. He'd spent many years at Darin, but this man didn't strike him as someone he knew. His jet-black hair hung in long ringlets to his shoulders, his smudged face partially obscured by a patchy beard. It hit him. Behind the changes prison had wrought on him was a man Terin should have recognized immediately.
"Sir Jonathan?"
"In the flesh," the man said. And then he punched Terin in the chest as hard as he could. A dull clang rang out, silencing the murmur of conversation amongst the soldiers. Sir Jonathan's hand snapped back, and he sucked on his knuckles, which were already starting to bruise from punching Terin's armor. He laughed, pulling in a sharp breath at the pain.
"That's for being a brutish bastard," the knight said. "Is he still a knight?" Terin wondered.
Depending on the severity of his crimes, Lord Darin may have stripped him of his knighthood.
"Good to see you, too," Terin said.
"'We'll catch up later,' Jonathan promised, finally stepping away and into the mob of soldiers. Terran shook his head. Darren was full of surprises, and he was glad one of them had finally been positive. Sir Jonathan was a mighty warrior, one he'd known for all 5 of the years he'd spent in Darren.
"'I will promote him first to a leadership position. Captain Morris will gladly be replaced.' "'What am I talking about?'
Terran had never been a commander before, always refusing offered promotions, content to keep his head down, follow orders, march wherever he was told to march, fight whomever he was told to fight.
"'But if not me, then who?' "'Captain Morris.'
The thought almost made him laugh, gallows humour and all that. If he didn't lead, the city was doomed. Well, more doomed than it already was. No, Fay was right. She might not have said it, but this was his penance, his way to protect the North. And by protecting the North, he was protecting Anise in the only way he knew how. Terran turned to face the crowd, not certain of exactly what he would say.
"'As most of you know, the East has rallied 6 battalions to take this city.'
"'Only 6?' someone in the crowd japed. Pockets of laughter.
"'Aye, and we should consider ourselves fortunate. I was here when the full might of the East, 50 battalions, assaulted the Razor, when the cliffs ran red with the blood of my comrades and enemies alike, when pain was but a reminder that we weren't dead, when corpses were piled to
Terran, Fay hissed. He glanced at her, the barest shake of her head. He took a deep breath. Right. Scaring these men was no way to convince them to fight for him. No, he needed to inspire them. How had his previous leaders convinced him to fight? They hadn't needed to, was the obvious answer. But these men were not him, and the next words he chose could make all the difference.
"'The past is the past,' he said, changing tact,
waving it away with one of his monstrous hands.
"'All we have is the present and the future. The great city of Darren is being threatened. I plan to defend it.'
"'Who are you again?'
someone shouted.
"'The Armored Knight, you dolt!'
another voice cried in response. Terran realized none of these men had ever seen his face, the truth of who, what he was. All they knew was his armor, which had become a symbol of him as a warrior, a stalwart soldier responsible for the deaths of hundreds of enemies.
"'I am not that man any more, not if I want to truly help my queen. I have to be more. I cannot hide from myself any longer.'
It was a risk, but at this point he had little to lose. He reached up with both hands, gripping the iron base of the helmet Fay had forged all those years ago, when he was just a scared little boy in a monster's body. And he removed his helmet. Muttering curses and whispering words like demon, sorcery, and witchcraft, half the men left. Maybe more. Terran hadn't exactly had time to conduct a roll call.
"'Half of nothing is still nothing,'
Terran thought.
"'Damn it! I must stop thinking like that, or I might as well leave with them.'
Half of them had stayed, even after seeing the true face of the man who planned to lead them into battle. Fay nodded at him encouragingly.
"'I am a man just like the rest of you,' he said.
He remembered how Anise had given her victory speech atop the wall at Castle Hill, how she'd met each soldier's eyes individually. He tried to do the same, scanning the crowd. Truth. That was all he had left.
"'I almost died as a boy. The act that saved my life changed me. That is a truth I cannot deny, cannot change, even if I wanted to. You all have the same choice as the men who left. Stay or go. When the Dread King ruled, you did not have that choice. To desert meant you'd be hunted down and executed. Now his daughter rules as your queen, and she is just as strong but fair, too. You can go where you will go, be with your families. Find a place to hide."
He let the idea float for a moment, before continuing.
"Or you can stand and you can fight.
You can reject the notion that the North can be conquered. You can shout at the top of your lungs that the North, even in its weakest state,